Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're going to do something a little bit different today. We spend, I would say, 90%+ of our time talking about how the right lost its mind, what's going on in Trump world with the Republicans. I want to take a slightly different take, at least at the beginning of this, which is why we invited Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine to join us to talk about this. First of all, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast. You're a Bulwark Podcast virgin, so we will try to make this as easy as possible.
Be gentle. I love what you guys write. I'm not a listener to your podcast or really anyone's podcast because I don't commute, but I really read the Bulwark a lot, and you guys are fun to read and smart, and I really enjoy it a lot. So I'm really glad you guys are around.
Well, I appreciate it. And so I want to, as I said before, I want to get your take, because I know you've written some pretty tough stuff about the Bernie Sanders campaign and the Bernie Bros, and I can sympathize, because I can see that we share one thing in common, that there are certain days where about 50% of the people who hate us are on the right and 50% who hate us are on the left, yeah. And you get it from both ends. And I've long experience being inflamed by the Trumpkins, and I've told people that you have to understand that a lot of the Bernie Bros are pretty much the same thing. It really does feel like a mirror image, and a lot of the things that we've experienced, that those of us on the right experienced back in 2015, 2016, seem very familiar when we're watching things on the left. Now, I don't know, do you think that's unfair? I'm not trying to draw a complete moral equivalency, but there is a real parallel between the mood in Bernie world to some of the things that we've experienced in Trump world.
So I think there are ways in which they're parallel and ways in which they're not parallel. Just so I accept part of your premise. Let me start with some of the ways in which I think they're not parallel. Number one, the most obvious is that Bernie didn't win. And he didn't win because the Democratic Party, it was in a totally different place than the Republican Party. It's a healthier party. It has I think more trust of its voters, and was able to fight off the insurrection and hostile takeover. Number two, I would say Bernie Sanders himself is very different from Donald Trump in a lot of ways. The most important of which is that Bernie Sanders is a political liberal. Donald Trump is an instinctive authoritarian. He loves authoritarians. He worships authoritarians. He has no respect for the rule of law, et cetera. That's not Bernie Sanders. For all the problems I have with Bernie Sanders, for instance, people, on the left were in this fad of shutting down right wing speakers on college campuses, and Bernie Sanders came out and said, no, we need to out debate them. What are you scared of? Hear out their ideas and beat them with better ideas. That's a classic political liberal approach. He's always been a small D Democrat. I think coming out of the 60s free speech liberal tradition. The Berkeley free speech liberal, those were people who really associated restrictions on free speech with the right and the establishment, and really had this idea of bringing their ideas to the public. Now, Bernie, I think, is way too idealistic that if he brings his ideas to the public, they'll accept them. He really thinks that if I could just make my spiel about the corporations, the 1%, one more time, everyone's gonna agree with me. but that is what he thinks.
If I just say it more times and louder, if I louder. Just say it louder,
yeah. Bring his ideas to the public, they're gonna fall in line. He really buys his own shtick on this. Now, I do think there are some similarities between the people who support Bernie Sanders. I think Bernie Sanders has inspired a lot of people on the left with some real illiberal tendencies, or if not quite illiberal tendencies, cruel tendencies, hostile tendencies, a real belief in shaming, beating down, shutting up their opposition. and just in general, a total lack of interest in engaging with their opposition intellectually whatsoever, or in any way crediting the assumption that people who disagree with them might even be misguided or dumb, but must be greedy and evil and hiding some hidden agenda. And in some ways, they can even exceed the right in that tendency. So I think a lot of their political behavior is similar. And I don't think that's an accident, because I think if you look at the analysis they have of the right, when you look at the way the far left talks about the right, I think their main position is envy. They don't, the way I look at what happened to the Republican Party is to look at it as a disaster and a cautionary tale. And they have been able to gain power in a lot of ways, but haven't had a lot of success at policy goals, and has brought the country to a terrible place. But I think the way the far left looks at it is really as a blueprint and a model that they want to emulate in a lot of ways. So that's where I think the similarities you're seeing are coming from.
See, that's what's so interesting, because I'm trying to think of the phrase that I think Jonah Goldberg had at one point, where he talked about that so many people on the right had Saul Alinsky envy, that they saw things on the left and they said, well, they get away with that, or these are their tactics, so let's adopt them. So in many ways, it does become circular. So let's just talk about the moment we're at right now. The campaign is, it feels like it's, well, it is over. And it's sort of in this weird zombie phase now, between now and whenever the convention, if there is a convention, takes place. But Bernie's in the race. So let's talk about that. Why is Bernie in the race, and what's the mood among Democrats? Now, I say this as I'm sitting here in Wisconsin, and we're actually theoretically going to have a primary next Tuesday. And 4 years ago, Bernie beat Hillary overwhelmingly here in Wisconsin in the Democratic primary. New poll out yesterday at the Marquette University Law poll shows that if, in fact, the primary takes place as scheduled, Biden would clean Bernie's clock here. Big, big, big margin. I think 30 points. So, look, this thing is over. It's done. Why is Bernie hanging on? And do Democrats understand that right now that Bernie is a major asset for the Republicans going into November?
Yeah, it's puzzling. You know, I would say to add one thing to the negative side of the ledger of my assessment of Bernie, he's hired some people who are much crazier than he is. He's, you know, because he's attracted, the people who have stuck with Bernie the most are some of the most radical people in progressive politics, and a lot of them really are outside the Democratic Party and really have no interest in the Democratic Party. He's got some Jill Stein voters there, some people who really have total contempt for the Democratic Party. So Bernie Sanders is the only thing they really care about. It's not, their attitude isn't going to be, all right, I'm just going to go work for Joe Biden, because they don't care about Joe Biden. They don't want Joe Biden to win at this point. They may come around to Joe Biden, but that's not really very important to them. It's not like a normal campaign where you pick what you think is your best candidate, and then you just move on to the next best candidate if that candidate doesn't win. So in part, it's the people he's got around him, probably pushing him in that direction. I may be making a risk of making an analogy to a movie not enough of your audience has seen to make it worthwhile, but Have you seen the movie Quick Change?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I haven't, but go with it.
Quick Change. Wonderful comedy. Planning to watch it again with Bill Murray, Gina Davis. Yeah, a bank heist. Robbers are successfully rob a bank and then spend the whole movie trying to get out of New York with increasing desperation and a lot of comic hijinks. And at the end, they get on this bus. They're trying to get on the airport. They got to catch the plane to get out of the country before the police catch them. And then one of the things that happens is this like old hippie gets on the bus, and the bus driver says, you've got to get off, you don't have the change. And he insists he's got to get on the bus. He's slowing the whole thing down. He's demanding it. And they're like, you know, they're desperate. The minutes are counting down. And you know, the Bill Murray is basically like pulls out this giant wad of cash. It basically says like, you know, I understand how the system has oppressed you. Please take this and start a new life off this bus. And like, but the guy doesn't care, right? He just wants, he's all focused on the injustice of what the system is doing to him, picking him off the bus. So that's
Bernie.
Is Bernie Sanders right now. Like he's all focused in, like in his world, he's not seeing the big picture. Bernie, you know, Bernie's like, his campaign is the campaign. You can't push Bernie Sanders off the campaign. Bernie's getting off the campaign when he wants to get off the campaign. And they don't care that everyone else is saying, like, we're trying to beat Donald Trump. We're trying to save the world. To us, this is, like, extremely important. I think Bernie, for the moment, is narrowly focused. Now, I think at the end, he's gonna get off the bus. You know, he's going to take his sweet time about it.
Does he take the money?
I need to watch the movie again. I can't remember if I said they do get him off the bus. I can't remember if they do induce him with bribes or some other way.
So there are some surveys that would suggest that somewhere between 15-20% of Bernie supporters, though, might actually. No, you correct me if I get this wrong. 15-20% won't vote for Biden, or is it 15-20% who might actually vote for Trump?
Yes. And you hear that, like I hear, you see that anecdotally, you know, people saying like their kids, as far as their kids are concerned, Joe Biden is a Republican. Joe Biden's no different from Trump from what they understand. That's basically the message they've absorbed. You know, I don't think they're following the campaign from the New York Times and the Washington Post. They're getting these lefty sources that basically present Joe Biden as, you know, kind of neoliberal racist sociopath. So they don't really see any difference between him and Trump. But I do think that'll change. I think if you look at the historical pattern of when the left tends to get disconsolate and sit out of elections, it tends to be when Democrats have been in power, usually for two terms. You can look at the Henry Wallace campaign. That's, you know, 1948, after four terms of Democratic presidencies. They're fed up. They don't care. You know, they're not going to vote. They're not going to vote for this Harry Truman Wall Street warmonger anymore. They're going their own way. 1968, again, after two terms, you didn't have a third party candidacy, but you had a lot of people basically sitting out and not willing to vote for Humphrey, dump the hump, not going to vote against Nixon. 2000, Bill Clinton's in office two terms, and all of a sudden, you know, Ralph Nader is running as a third party spoiler. And you have 2.5% going for Nader. And you had that again in 2016 after two Obama terms. You had Jill Stein and you know, a lot of people on the left. So I think that's the pattern. And my guess is Trump is going to be enough to hold the party together this time.
I mentioned before we started the podcast, just for the listeners to know, because this is something that I've never discussed on the podcast. We haven't written about it. We haven't covered it. I think most of the media has decided to at least put this aside for the moment. But one of the more disturbing parts of Bernie world, and Bernie Sanders himself can't necessarily be blamed for all of this, because when I describe Bernie world, it's beyond just his own campaign into the media outlets that are pushing him. There is this drumbeat to push a story by a woman who alleges that Joe Biden had sexually assaulted her back in 1993, and her name is Tara Reid. And there's tremendous pressure on the part of certain segments of the left media, which is and parallel on the right media as well. So if I look at The Intercept or National Review, they're basically saying, why is the media not talking about this woman, Tara Reid? So give me your sense. And again, this goes back to sort of the toxicity of some of the Bernie folks, that this race is over. It is done. It's going to be Biden versus Trump at a rather fraught moment in American politics. And they're pushing this, you know, this headshot against Joe Biden. Do they honestly think it's going to take him out?
So I read a story by a feminist writer named Amanda Marcotte. I also have sort of talked to a bunch of other journalists about this story. I don't know if it's true. There are serious questions about the credibility. Nothing that makes you say it can't be true, but enough to say this doesn't cross the threshold of what I think deserves to be covered. At this point, based on what I've gathered, I'm not going to stake my credibility on saying it can't be true, but I think there's a decent chance it's not true. So number one,
Okay, go ahead.
But I think you identified the incentive structure. They're not going to they're not going to beat Biden by finding another clip of him saying something conservative. Or, you know, they need what you say is a headshot. So they're obviously highly motivated to believe this story because they believe they need to totally disqualify him. And then, but you know, what also is crazy about it, in my opinion, is I think the Democratic electorate has made it very clear they don't want to nominate Bernie Sanders. It's not that they're attached to Joe Biden. Like, Joe Biden's support collapsed when it looked like he wasn't going anywhere, but it pretty much... Stanton Herndon wrote this for the New York Times. He interviewed dozens of Democratic voters, and basically they were just looking for whoever could beat Bernie Sanders as the nominee. So the idea that if somehow you could disqualify Joe Biden, it should go to Biden, it should go to Sanders, when two-thirds of the party really doesn't want to nominate that guy, and is basically their second choice is Bernie, and their first choice is anybody else who's running against Bernie. That seems crazy to me. But so. It's a pretty wild plan, but this is what they're unfortunately incentivized to do by Bernie staying in the race.
Some of the reaction in the conservative media is not so much whether we believe her or not. It is the double standard, and it's the look. During the Kavanaugh hearings, you insisted to us that we had to believe all women. That was the standard. And if you apply the standard that a lot of people on the left applied to Brett Kavanaugh, then shouldn't Biden be simply presumed to be guilty? So, I mean, this is what a lot of folks were arguing with straight faces recently, a year and a half ago, that if there was an allegation, you must believe the woman. And so you can really see that sort of there's some gleeful whataboutism going on now in the right, saying, look, you folks, look what you did. Look what you've done when you're accusing a Republican. Shouldn't you be held to the same standard? Now, by the way, I can't vouch for this, but one of the things that I'm seeing online in Bernie world is they're enjoying the fact that it looks like some of the Biden staffers are deleting the tweets that they had written about believing all women back in Kavanaugh, so that they recognize that this is going to be an awkward moment for them.
So I'd like to make two points.
Sure.
So number one, I'm not person who's used that phrase "believe women" because I think it's imprecise. But if you ask a lot of feminists who do use that slogan, most of them will say they don't intend it to mean "believe all women." The "all" is usually inserted by people who are their critics. And what they say when they mean "believe women" is to approach accusations from a standpoint of openness to evidence, and not from a position of reflexive denialism or demanding standards of proof that are almost impossible to meet, you know, such as like having it being caught on videotape. Now, again, I think there are problems with that slogan because it's pretty reasonable to hear "believe women" and think it means "believe all women."
It does play that way, yeah.
So I don't use that line, but they're pretty insistent that they don't really mean it that way. And I would say if you look at the way they use it for them, there are cases where you'd say, all right, they gave credence to an accusation that's too flimsy. I think on the whole, they're relatively responsible. Like when I've looked at the way the Me Too movement has played out in the media, I don't think I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I think they've made some pretty reasonable points. If they're off here and there, I think on the whole, they've done a pretty responsible job. If you read writers like Michelle Goldberg and Rebecca Traister, they're saying we need to weigh evidence. We need to keep, you know, the logic of the justice system and that you can make a defense and so on. I don't think it's been a witch hunt on the most part. But not that I don't have criticisms here and there, but I think on the whole it's been responsible. Second point, and I think this is more important, lots of people do this, and I think this is something people on all sides do, of basically starting with the worst offense, worst logic of the opposing side, and then embracing it as your own. Your error gives me logic to do the same thing. And that's not a race to the bottom. Like, it is the bottom. Once you do that, it's you've just abandoned all logical standards, all fairness, There's nothing to talk about. There's nothing left. I don't even see any point of talking to people who use that logic, because that's giving yourself license to lie.
Yeah, and that's that spiral that we were talking about before, where, you know, the bad behavior of the other side then becomes the model, and you have the envy of it, and you do see this on, and I'm sorry to use the phrase because I know that it offends some people, you really do see this on both sides, that they will come up with some terrible thing that the other side did, and which then justifies them. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the defense of Donald Trump simply is looking for somebody else that has done something that we can make the story. That whatever he has done,
especially because it's a big country, right? You can always find somebody on the other side who stepped off the line that you can use as your own permission.
All right, so we're talking about Bernie Sanders, who I think is completely irrelevant now, and it feels very much of a digression at a moment when you and I are sitting here trying to absorb the fact that you may have 100 to 200,000 Americans dying in the next several months because of this pandemic, and watching as 10 million Americans so far have lost their jobs. I mean, the economic numbers and the economic story itself is reality. You know, it shakes your sense of reality. So we are in this amazing political moment. So, As you're sitting back, I mean, how are you processing the fact that we are facing an economic catastrophe and a medical disaster at the same time that we're in the midst of these political wars? I'm giving you the broadest question because I don't know how I'd answer that question.
It's obviously very terrifying. I feel like I don't know if this is the interesting thing for your audience. I've managed to psychologically process it. I went through a period of pervasive dread, unlike anything I've ever experienced in my whole life. Mm-hmm. I'm a very optimistic person. I had a week or two when I couldn't escape a feeling of dread. I've really never had that ever. Mm-hmm. 9/11 affected everyone I know except for me emotionally. I always felt thinking like there was something weird about me. Like I wasn't tearing up. I wasn't feeling things. I mean, I thought like, I mean, I understood that it was terrible, but I wasn't feeling emotions. People have like called me Spock throughout my life. Like people know me, call me, that's kind of who I am. But this has been on a totally different order. It's been oppressive. It's been horrible to think about. And in part because it's the boundlessness, which is, I think, part of what you're getting at, right? It's boundlessness of the danger. People could be dying of this a year from now. And the boundlessness of the economic impact, right? The CBO now projects that at the end of next year, unemployment will be 9%. That's great recession levels at the end of next year, end of 2021.
Wow.
Which is just awful. Can I ask you? Can I turn around and ask you a question? Because this is something that my liberal friends have been most befuddled by about the conservatives, and obviously you know that world better than I do. I thought I understood the conservatives in the Republican Party. I can't understand why Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and the mainstream Republicans are all throwing cold water on doing another economic rescue bill right now. To me, they're digging their own political grave. Aside from putting morality aside, they're just handing the election to the Democrats.
Well, okay, I'm going to get to that question but I also wanted to just say that I really shared your kind of emotional reaction to this, and I think it's fascinating that I went through that same sort of dread, and I was trying to think about why this is different, you know, and it is your own personal economic future. You are touched in a way that other crises have not touched you. This is very, very real. It's also your total lack of control over it. Mm-hmm. The grisliness of it. And it is also part of the lack of faith that people are going to get this right, that we're in the midst of this, that we still are awash in the lies, the disinformation, the cynicism, and that it's not going to be that we're going to rally around and the good guys are eventually going to get and we're going to pop back. it feels that, and I think that part of it adds to that sense of dread, because it takes many of the negative things that we've been experiencing and it just shoves the meter all the way. So this gets to the political reaction. I sense that a lot of people on the right who are all in on Donald Trump, I almost sense this tone of hysteria now, because they realize how dangerous this is. This is existential, and they are so deeply invested that they can't let go. And so, you know, even as it's going down, they're just clinging on with, you know, the fingernails. So Mitch McConnell has this opportunity, at least, to cover himself by moving ahead. But I think, again, this is something that conservative Republicans, I'm kind of spitballing here because I don't know how his mind works, but their ideology right now is particularly ill-suited for this particular moment. You know, it's easy to confront a foreign foe. It is more problematic to deal with something that we, you know, had happened back in 2009, 2010. Remember, you know, much of the conservative resurgence that we're living through right now came in reaction to the rescue packages, TARP and the auto bailouts. So here you have this moment. They recognize they needed to do something last week with a $2 trillion package. But, you know, there's still sort of that residual, well, you know, are we simply going to go along now with liberal Democrats and throw money at all of this sort of thing? And I don't think that they understand where they're at. And plus, look, there is a certain paralysis when you face something like this. But this is an excellent question, because I don't know how you feel about this, but, you know, sitting here when we're talking about it, it seems increasingly unlikely that that $2 trillion package is going to be enough to prevent the country from going into what's going to look like a depression, not just a recession. So you know that they have to do something else, and they seem out of bullets, and they seem out of imagination.
Yeah, and I've seen some right wingers make ideological arguments against economic stimulus. You know, the supply siders, in particular, Art Laffer, Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal editorial page, basically thinks stimulus doesn't work. I haven't really seen Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell make those kinds of arguments under a Republican presidency. They made them under Obama, but they didn't make those kinds of arguments previously. They didn't make them when George W. Bush was president. They passed a stimulus in early 2008. So the model that I had was that their opposition to stimulus was purely cynical, that they only embraced this idea of you know, liquidationism and the way to fight a recession is to cut spending when a Democrat was in office, and they were happy to pass stimulus bills under Republicans. They did it under Bush. They did it again recently. But so they're not really saying that stimulus doesn't work or the deficit's too high. They're just saying what they're saying is, well, let's just wait. Let's just see how this goes. But like, what is the risk of overshooting on your economic rescue as opposed to the risk of undershooting?
Well, that's the problem. At this point, trying to figure out what the level of risk is, and I'm guessing Mitch McConnell just simply doesn't want to give Nancy Pelosi any of her wish list. I will tell you this, though, and this is not a direct answer to your question, because I don't know the answer to your question, really. I mean, clearly the concern about debt was a ruse for years, and we knew this before this was happening, and now that we've just, I mean, the fact that you have Republicans talking about a possibly $6 trillion, you know, expenditure, then, you know, what the whole last several decades of talking about fiscal conservatism seem rather bizarre. But all of the energy that I'm seeing on the right now seems to be in two areas. Number one, and this is something that's familiar to us, and I, by the way, have a hard time still grasping the psychology behind it. All of the energy seems to be in rallying around defending Trump no matter what, coming up with some sort of excuse. So if you go on, you look at the fundraising letters, you look at the social media, it's all, let's make sure that Trump doesn't take the fall for this. Let's make sure that the Democrats get blamed for distracting him by impeachment, or that they also made mistakes. And hey, look at Bill de Blasio. Up until 2 days ago or 3 days ago, there was the drumbeat that this was overhyped, or the Rush Limbaughs of the world who were insisting all of this was simply just another, you know, plan to take down Donald Trump. And also there was tremendous, I think energy saying don't go too far in shutting down the economy. I still think that's there. I think that what you're going to see, and I could be wrong about all of this because I was not sure that the president was going to come as close to reality as he did by extending the shutdown. But I'm guessing that there are going to be many, many voices in his ear telling him he's got to restart the economy no matter what the numbers are. Now, maybe he'll resist that. But for a lot of conservatives, the only stimulus that they really can, you know, unreservedly support is bringing the economy back, opening the doors again, and just hoping that everything returns to normal, that things snap back.
I think that's right. It's right. So Trump is on his fourth position now. He started off, the coronavirus is just the flu, it's no big deal. He went into, I'm going to be a wartime president, defeat the invisible enemy. He flipped back to saying, no, the cure can't be worse than the disease, although he didn't, worse than the problem. And then he reversed himself again. So the odds that he's going to stick on this position aren't great.
No, they're not great. Oh, I left out one of the big ones, which is going to be, of course, blame everything on China. Which really is very much a sweet spot. If you can blame this on China and the lack of a wall, if you can blame this on immigrants, Democrats, and the media, that's a comfortable place for a lot of conservatives. Now, as you know, none of that actually solves the problems that we are discussing. But this is something else, and I don't know whether you and I have discussed this in the past. What it really, really strikes me is how many conservatives, I think, have gotten away from trying to solve problems in the real world as opposed to striking a position or an attitude, because, you know, we're going to, and this is, I think, the problem going through 2020. What proposal do they have, you know, that will legitimately put tens of millions of Americans back to work, will solve all of this? And this is not their strong suit. And I think it's being exposed right now.
Yeah. So this is the hypothesis I saw from, I think Brendan Nyhan or someone else, another political scientist, was as follows, that most of the conservatives felt very good about Trump's reelection prospects. And then when this hit and so immediately hurt his chances of reelection, if nothing else, just by its effect on the economy and economic growth, denial became the only psychological place for them. So it's less of a strategy as a way for them to just process emotionally having to go from feeling great about Trump to all but conceding the election. And if you follow the economic forecasts of the CBO and other places, he's going to lose. He's just going to – the election was the only thing holding him up, and it's gone from his biggest advantage to a massive liability. Your parachute has turned into a lead weight you're holding. So –
That sounds right to me. And you know, you remember that moment because I know you were writing some pretty strong columns about, you know, telling Democrats don't, you know, you'd be crazy if you did X, Y, and Z. Well, the flip side, if you went to CPAC, I mean, imagine, let's just take when was CPAC? Was that in February?
Yeah.
At that moment, they were giddy with anticipation. Yeah. They thought the Democrats were going to nominate Bernie Sanders that guaranteed Donald Trump's reelection, guaranteed they would hold the Senate, and there was real optimism. And I think it was genuine optimism that they could possibly flip the House of Representatives. Yeah. So, I mean, it was happy times are here again, and then somebody coughs in Wuhan. And so it's very difficult when you think you have something and you're entitled to it. You know, all of the sacrifices and compromises they made were going to be validated by this. And I do think that is that sort of psychological processing that they're going through. And a certain amount of denial as well. So you just said you think he's going to lose here. There's the school of thought.
I'm not guaranteeing it, but. You know, if the economy is still flat or negative in the third,
it will be.
I mean, I think they're counting on a rapid bounce back. I mean, you still even like a week ago, you had people saying, all right, the economy is going to shrink 20% annual pace in the second quarter, but by the third quarter, it'll be back to 10% growth. Right? You'll have rapid catch up growth, like after a natural disaster. You shut it down, you open it back up. We don't know enough about how this is going to play out to say that that's impossible. if that happens, you know, I could see him winning. But that doesn't, that's not what people are expecting.
I also wonder, there's a psychological lag that if you've experienced 6 months of just a horrific downturn, whether or not the fact that the economy is coming back will be, you know, would be enough to change people's attitudes about whether or not their life is better off than it was 4 years ago. And I'm thinking back, and maybe I'm going to get this wrong, but, you know, in 1992, George H.W. Bush had, you know, just presided over this terrible, terrible economy. Yeah. But by the time of the election, the economy was already sort of coming back, wasn't it? Yeah. Do I have this, the election right? But of course, nobody felt that. Nobody believed it. And when, you know, every once in a while, somebody would say, hey, you know, actually, the economy is on the right track right now. Nobody wanted to hear it. So it was a little bit too late. So you've written about this poll bump that he's received. And you are somewhat skeptical that his, hey, don't blame me. This is not my fault. I take no responsibility. You don't think that's going to wear well between now and November?
I don't, because I think what he's benefiting from is the inherent tendency of people in a crisis to rally around their leader and hope that leader succeeds. But I think that sentiment inherently is attached to holding that leader responsible for solving it. I think to the extent that that exists, they're saying, we need you to solve this. So if he doesn't solve it, I just don't see how you pivot to it's somebody else's fault. That just goes against everything I understand about human nature. Again, we have to be a little modest about our ability to predict these things. So maybe we're getting it all wrong, or maybe something else will happen. But that I just can't even think of an example of a leader who survived.
No, I can't either.
On his term, not one he inherited, but one that happened while they were there, and said, it's not my fault.
Well, and also the bump is so modest compared to every other leader. I mean, you can compare it to the bump that the governors have gotten, Andrew Cuomo has gotten, or compare it to other world leaders, or the historic bumps that, again, George H.W. Bush, George Bush, George and his son both got to 90% at various points. There's no chance that Trump is ever going to enjoy that kind of, and the sound bites that he's creating.
Jimmy Carter.
Oh, my God. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, he had a huge bump at one point. And there's no way that Trump gets there. And also, again, these sound bites that he's creating. I mean, if the Democrats are not completely brain dead, they should have, you know, these ads in the can, quite frankly. Why is Michael Bloomberg not spending, you know, a couple of extra $100 million putting these ads up like he said he was going to? I mean, they ought to be pounding the airways with this stuff right now, shouldn't they?
I'm seeing it online almost every new day. They're taking yesterday's Trump press conference and cutting it up for ads. I mean, Trump is just filming Biden ads every single day. Like, liberals are complaining about the press conference. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, you just give him a studio.
So should the networks keep airing these press conferences, which have become a little bit more ludicrous every day, including the one on Wednesday where they decided they were just going to make some announcement about the drug trafficking or something, which had nothing to do with the coronavirus.
I mean, you should be covering them, but it's not standard practice just to automatically put the president on the air. I mean, presidents give speeches all the time that are not broadcast on cable news. Why?
So, yeah, that's what I don't understand. It's also like they haven't learned the lesson from 2016. The other interesting thing to watch, though, is in this age of viral whataboutism, you know, people like Byron York from the Washington Examiner said, no, here's the real dilemma for anti-Trump folks, that you have to explain why other people were also slow to get this. And my response was, you know, it is actually possible to have two things in your head at the same time. It's possible to think that China has acted very, very badly and not trust them, and still think that the Trump administration was, you know, criminally late and slow in reacting. It's certainly possible to think that Bill de Blasio was a shambolic mess, but also that Donald Trump needs to be held accountable for his reaction, that you don't, that everything does not have to be binary, but you can see, I can always see the narrative forming that if you went into Fox World, if we dropped you into alternative reality where people would say, you know, well, Donald Trump is the great leader. He didn't delay. He, you know, did everything, you know, right from the beginning. And to the extent that he didn't, which he did, it was Nancy Pelosi's fault because of impeachment. Interesting yeah. point of view. So it's the media and the Democrats have been trying to destroy Donald Trump. This is their latest effort. Even as I say that, that becomes harder and harder, especially as these numbers pile up. And it's sort of like we, you know, some of us have been waiting for when is reality going to catch up with the hype and the spin? And these numbers every single day, whether they're the economic numbers or whether they're the death count numbers, they just seem hard to spin away. They just, even for the Fox News folks, even for Rush Limbaugh.
I think that's right. So, right. So as for the dilemma, the sort of what about his dilemma, I agree that if the choice was Donald Trump or the Chinese Communist Party as the two choices, right. that would be hard. That would be a tough election to work through. I really want to know more about what the Chinese Communists were planning. You know, is it going to be a great revolution? You know, is it going to be a great leap forward? Is it going to be a cultural revolution? But that's not the dilemma. So there really isn't a dilemma. As for reality biting, I mean, I think it's not that complicated if you just zoom all the way out to 20,000 feet. And from 20,000 feet, you'd say, given the state of the economy, Trump should be a shoo-in for re-election, and he's been behind, right? Given the economic growth, he should be at 53% approval rating, and he's at 45% approval rating. So he's got a disconcertingly high floor, but he's also screwed up a lot of things. So if things go the way they unfortunately seem to be going, you know, there really is, it'll become much more interesting to see what this floor looks like. Now obviously every candidate keeps most of their party base. Herbert Hoover had almost 40%, right, in 1932.
Yes,
he was, you know, right, and so that means he kept three quarters of his 1928 vote. So that's what the floor looks like. The floor means you only keep 75% of your supporters. So the world isn't going to look like you're seeing Trump supporters all over the place abandon him. Most people who voted for Trump are going to vote for Trump again. It's all on the margins. But given the fact that we had something like peace and prosperity for most of the presidency, and now we're in a totally different period, this floor question is really going to be much, much more interesting. But honestly, I have to say, getting back to the sort of dread of the moment, I've stopped worrying so much about Trump winning. In fact, the scenarios that concern me are scenarios where Biden gets 59%, because those aren't really worlds I want to live in. Like, I want him to get 59%, but the conditions that cause him to get 59% are pretty terrible.
Oh, yeah. No, that would be, yes. Well, but here's the good news. As you point out, writing in the magazine, we have Jared Kushner, who's in charge of this. He's been studying. He's been learning. And now he's an expert in pandemic response. See, you know, part of the dread, you mentioned a movie before. Part of my dread is that we're living in this absolutely absurdist movie and nobody gets it. It's like, you know, how is Jared Kushner not just a source of both humor and dread all of the time? I mean, the son-in-law who just knows everything and has created his own shadow task force. I mean, we are so effed. You know, if we made the joke, yes, it's going to be Jared and Ivanka will save America from the pandemic right after they bring peace to the Middle East.
And the thing is, I can't rule out the possibility that that's actually our best hope right now, that the state of the government is so terrible that the people he's putting together are actually more competent than the alternative. That's entirely plausible to me.
So are you in New York or in D.C.?
DC. I'm in DC. I work from home.
Okay. All right. I'm just trying to imagine what life must be like, you know, in New York. And I also would just wonder what the cracking point is. And we've talked about this on the podcast. I sense right now that people are still have a pretty good spirit, about the lockdown. I mean, it's inconvenient and everything, but it's still, you know, I think people, you know, there's a certain novelty. People understand the importance of it, but there's going to come a point where it becomes just too much. I mean, the personal, financial, psychological strain of it. And I just, and I think it's very unpredictable how that's going to play out, particularly if this economic problem, you know, the economic collapse is as bad as it looks like it's going to be, the possibility for unrest again, this is part of the globalized dread. We just don't know where we're going. Right. And I have very little confidence in certain officials. I think in New York, you have a governor who seems to be on the case right now. But we just don't know what is the breaking point for folks.
You know, I think you're probably right. I think people are going to have a stiff upper lip to start off with. We don't know how long it will last. I don't think the economic measures implemented by the government are enough. You know, there are some moderate conservatives, like at the American Enterprise Institute, has a really interesting little pod of sort of iconoclastic thinkers who have been pushing for these small business loans, which are really more like grants, where basically the government gives money to businesses to just keep their payroll intact, so the businesses don't dissolve, because you have nothing to build or reopen if they're gone. And most small businesses can't survive 2-3 months without any income. And they're saying, great, we included this, but it's like 1/4 of the necessary size. So, which again goes back to my question. What are the Republicans in Congress thinking? Throw money at the problem.
Yeah, well, see, this is the problem. Most of them ran for office saying this was what they did not do. And so they've been willing to surrender a lot of things. But I think that may be the bridge too far. Hey, so, Jonathan, while we have been talking, in terms of breaking news, a story that I follow very, very closely, but I also think is incredibly relevant and is going to be an indication of other things we're going to face nationally. A federal judge declined to postpone Wisconsin's scheduled April 7th primaries amid widespread worries that holding elections during the pandemic would risk public health. Now, that's just not just a presidential primary. That's also a general election here in Wisconsin. So this ruling by Judge William Connolly means that Wisconsin will remain the only one of 11 states originally scheduled to hold elections in April that has not postponed or dramatically altered voting amid the pandemic. But this is what he did do. He issued a 53-page ruling. He extended the deadline for absentee ballots to be received by local election officials by a full week, from 8 p.m. on April 7th to 4 p.m. on April 13th. So I think he's probably right that he didn't have the power to postpone the election. But this is an indication. I think people should really watch Wisconsin. This is an indication of the kind of chaos that we will have in, you know, nationally, if we don't come to grips with the need to make some election changes, including making it much easier to vote by mail between now and November. Because, you know, you want to talk about a bad case scenario, an election in which hundreds of thousands or millions of voters are potentially disenfranchised, and then an election whose very legitimacy is questioned because it's taken place. I mean, it's...
I'm really glad you brought that up, and I don't see how you can discuss it without being partisan about it, because the opposition is entirely from one side. And some Republicans say, right, Trump said that if you have this vote by mail, you'll have voting at levels that a Republican would never win again, which I don't think is true. But you just had an official in Georgia saying the same thing, that basically, like, if you give all these people mail ballots, they'll vote, and voter turnout will be so high and we'll lose elections. And this seems to be the reason why Republicans don't do the very easy, logical step: send a ballot to everyone at home, vote by mail. Some states do it universally. It works extremely well. There's no voter fraud from it. The only reason we're not doing it is that Republicans think it will cause voter turnout to be high and they'll lose.
Yeah, and they have pre-positioned the argument that you can't do it because it would create massive voter fraud. I mean, that is something that the base has been predisposed to believe, and that's the argument that you're hearing across the board. In fact, I was talking with somebody about this morning that I think there's a certain naivete on the part of some folks who think that, well, this is the obvious good government solution to make it easier to do it, assuming that people will deal with this in good faith. Do not count on this. The opposition on the right will be much stronger. In fact, I'm looking at a survey right now that somebody emailed me, and it's from, you probably are more familiar with this than I am. It's called Change Research. I should be able to source it, but the screen I have up on right up now is, it's a survey. One idea being proposed is allowing everyone to vote by mail in the November election for president so that people can still cast their ballots without risking their health by going to crowded polling places. Do you support or oppose this idea? All respondents, 65% support it. 93% of Democrats support it. 70% of independents support it, but fewer than a third of Republicans support it. Yep. Only 32% of Republicans support the vote by mail. 68% are opposed. So I think that tells you how this is going to play out politically.
I think that's absolutely right. That's why Republicans refused to go as far as Democrats wanted. They wanted to use the last bill, fully fund vote by mail, because, you know, these state budgets are getting destroyed by the economy. Their revenues are going down. Their costs are going up. They can't afford it. So giving them the money to stand up this operation is necessary, in addition to mandating it. The Republicans only grudgingly gave a small share of the money and didn't require it. But it's so we have evidence. There are states, there are a handful of states that have vote by mail. There isn't voter fraud there. It's not prone to voter fraud. It's very resistant to voter fraud. Because you mail the ballot out to the individual at their home. So you can check to see who's eligible when you send out the ballots. It's very easy. So there's not only no evidence of voter fraud, there's strong evidence that it doesn't have voter fraud. No one's found voter fraud in this system, but Republicans do truly believe not only that any system that creates more turnout is voter fraud, but that I think they've taught themselves to just equate higher turnout with voter fraud, so that they don't even have to think very hard. And maybe you can tell me if I'm thinking about it wrong. But
no.
what I've noticed is that you've got a handful of people in the movement on almost every issue. You've got a handful of people who take the strongest interest in an issue. So if Republicans are thinking about climate change, they've got their climate folks, right? You've got your climate guy. You've got the guy at Cato. You've got the guy at Heritage. They're the specialist, and they're the ones who are going to tell you what the position should be, and you sort of go with what the experts. You've got this on most issues, and I think with voting and political process reforms, you've got a handful of conservatives who are really rabid advocates of vote suppression is the only way I think you can fairly describe it. They really are opposed to anything that's going to make it easier for people to vote. And those people and the party just tends to defer to them. And if they say it's voter fraud, then it's voter fraud. And that's where it ends.
And I also think there's the belief that the larger the turnout, the more likely that electorate is going to favor the Democrats, which may or may not be true. But if you articulate that position, you're basically articulating a flat out undemocratic position on this. And unfortunately, I think that's become internalized on the right. Well, you know, we're out of time here, but you know, you were mentioning the fact that there's not enough money to shore up the economy. And I think that one of the stories that's coming out now that bolsters your position is the fact that, you know, a lot of Americans may have to wait months for these relief checks. That it's one thing to pass legislation, but now we're hearing this one NBC report suggesting that some people, you know, won't get their checks until the middle of April, and many might have to wait months and months if they don't have direct deposit. So this is one of those things where the speed of the money is as important as the amount of the money and whether it's going to actually go to the right people. And you know, unfortunately, my level of confidence they're going to get this right is extremely low, and the consequences of that are, you know, incredibly grave.
Yeah, I'm also concerned, but to me, I can see why they would go from that to say, well, let's not throw even more money at the problem.
Yes,
I think the more realistic answer is to say, well, if there really is this lag time problem, let's get the next phase going right now. If that's going to take 3 months to stand up, don't you want that to come out in July instead of October?
Well, one thing, and I'm acknowledging here that I didn't really give you a good answer to your question about Mitch McConnell's thinking here. You know that Mitch McConnell's main priority is to protect his majority in the Senate, which I think is extremely at risk right now.
Absolutely.
Extremely at risk.
Really? Yeah.
And it's always a bad idea to predict something that will happen that's never happened in the past. But there is a long and rich history of members of the United States Senate or members of a political party finding the moment to distance themselves from the president. Now, they've had many opportunities to do that, and they have rejected them all and probably will continuing. But if this continues to play out, because so much is unpredictable, you wonder whether or not McConnell will try to save some of his vulnerable seats by saying, look, we're not going along with everything that Trump is doing. Trump's on his own. Again, the evidence against that is, I think, overwhelming, the psychological evidence. But you do wonder whether or not you're going to start to see some cracks there because, well, by November, it'll be every man for himself.
Well, look, if unemployment is double digits in October,
which it will be, yeah.
If the economy is still shrinking or is flat, they're not only going to lose their Senate majority, they could be losing seats in Tennessee, in Texas. Mitch McConnell's seat.
Georgia.
Georgia. Yeah. Mitch McConnell could personally lose his seat if the economy is in depression in the fall. So why doesn't Mitch McConnell want to take out another $5 trillion insurance policy to make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, I remember 1980. I mean, now that you say this, I'm having a flashback to 1980, and I was a young reporter, and I was covering one of the rallies. I don't think people really realized that Ronald Reagan was going to win by a landslide. And I was at an event where Senator Gaylord Nelson, revered, very, very popular senator from Wisconsin, was speaking, and he was sort of running through what the Senate would look like if the Republicans took the Senate, and he was talking about it. And there was a certain ludicrous, caricature that he was drawing, because, of course, it could never happen. A guy like Gaylord Nelson could never lose for re-election, and then he did. And so in an election like that, in a change wave election like that, you have, your vulnerables, but then people that you never, ever thought would be vulnerable who are swept out. And I think that's something that a guy like Mitch McConnell is going to keep his eye on. So, Jonathan Shea, thank you so much for all the time you spent with us. I appreciate it very, very much.
Well, thank you very much. It was a really interesting discussion, and I love your work, and thank you so much for having me on.
And thank you for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.